Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion Podcast. Fish are amazing creatures with a diversity of colors, shapes, and sizes. They truly are a diverse group of animals, and so are humans. This podcast is more about people than fish, which is also the case in fisheries, believe it or not. Any fisheries manager will tell you, it's about working with people. The fish are the easy part.
Here we focus on people and on extremely important topics, including the benefits of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the field of fisheries and aquatic sciences. Some topics may be uncomfortable at times, but this will be a safe zone from which everyone can learn. Although this is an initiative led by graduate students and supported by the American Fisheries Society and the Fisheries Podcast, it applies everywhere and to everyone and transcends fisheries.
We strive for everyone to feel involved and included, no matter your country of origin, age, ethnicity, gender, religion, sexuality, and/or disability. Hosts and guests are sharing their personal views, which they hold as their own.
Humans struggle between what is right and wrong. Our personal morals and ethics are shaped by cultural norms and the ones that surround us, including our family, friends, classmates, and colleagues. Our podcast would like to critique your philosophy by challenging some of your personal beliefs regarding right and wrong.
We are so glad you chose to listen and open your mind to these very important conversations. Thank you for joining us.
All right, hello and welcome to the AFS Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion Podcast. In this episode, we're going to talk about white privilege. It's kind of a buzzword. It can be a little scary. It can be a little intimidating, but let's dive in. First, we're going to start with introductions. Hello, my name is Cassidy Miles. I work for the Missouri Department of Conservation, and I'm one of the co-hosts of the Diversity Inclusion Podcast. Today, I have a very special guest, Dr. Jason DeBoer. Would you like to introduce yourself?
I would love to. My name is Jason. Pronouns are he, his, him. I am a large river fisheries ecologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey, part of the University of Illinois.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing your pronouns. I forgot to do that. So that is a good reminder. I use pronouns she, her, and hers. And thank you very much, Jason, for sharing yours. My privilege. That could be a really scary phrase. When people see it, it either triggers anger or some other kind of emotion. This can be an uncomfortable topic to cover, but in order to make progress in diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts, we need to become comfortable with having these uncomfortable conversations. So that's why we're really thankful to have this platform in the podcast to talk about various issues in diversity, equity, and inclusion. And thank you, Jason, for joining me today to talk about this.
You're welcome. I am probably the poster child for white privilege in that I am a white male in a largely white profession. And kind of leading up to this podcast, I had my own ideas of what I thought white privilege was, but I wanted to confirm that. So I did a little bit more reading and actually broadened my own horizons and enlightened myself a little bit about what it actually means. So I guess that was good for me to learn too.
Definitely. I think that's the whole thing with working towards diversity, equity, and inclusion in whatever society or group that you are a part of. It's having to learn new things, but also maybe unlearn some things as well, and really diving into that self-education, even though it can be really disheartening sometimes, exhausting, and sometimes can take you aback because you maybe realized something that you've never known, and it can completely change how you think about something. So that whole self-education is extremely important. I'm glad that it had you do your own research and you looked up some stuff too. I mean, that's the whole reason why we're here. So the first thing with white privilege, some people assume that the definition is that white people have never struggled. That is not the case at all. So the first, I think, way we need to define white privilege is by what it is not. And that is what I used to think it was, meaning like white people don't have problems. That's definitely not what the definition is. It is also not assuming that everything a white person has was not unearned. I think a lot of people think that's what white privilege means, that they were just given everything. And that's definitely not the case either. So that's where I had to start, was doing some self-education and figuring out what exactly does this phrase mean and break it down. And why did it trigger anger in me at first? And it's because I didn't fully understand the definition.
I agree. I came from a very similar place in terms of what I thought I understood white privilege to be. Traditionally understood definitions can can be unsettling. They can be uncomfortable, in large part because they're inaccurate. That's the hard part to hear, is that you've been handed everything because you're a white male. It's easier for you. Well, it is easier for me, but that doesn't discount the fact that I worked very hard to get where I am. So,
definitely, exactly. So I had also a short definition that came from Corey Collins from learningforjustice.org. There's a whole excellent article on that website, Breaking Down White Privilege, and we'll have that linked in the bio of the podcast. But they stated, white privilege should be viewed as a built-in advantage separate from one's level of income or effort. And that one I had to stop and think about as well. It's like a built-in advantage where it's almost something that as a white person, you don't have to think about certain things because the color of your skin doesn't add an extra barrier or wall that you have to deal with, I think, is sort of the way that I was looking at it.
Yeah, absolutely. Whether it's the color of your skin or the style of your hair or even how your name is pronounced or spelled, you know, the way that appears, you have a traditionally white name that has built-in advantages. You know, if you look like everybody else in your profession, that has built-in advantages too. And those are the things that we need to understand and help to spread the word on.
Absolutely.
I really enjoyed that whole article. That was one of the things that I read leading up to this, and it was enlightening to me.
Yes, I really like that it also kind of breaks down how the definition of white privilege has changed over time. Because there are some ways you can look at it. As a white person, I can see myself in media, television shows, movies. When you go to the grocery store, there are hair care products. There's things that are flesh colored, like Band-Aids or pantyhose, those types of things. They're in my skin color. So it's not something I have to think about. It's not something I have to go hunting for. And that was kind of like the baseline definition of what do you see as you go out? Are you represented? Are you having to have a special aisle for your hair care products, that kind of thing? And some people may think like it's such a small, like trivial thing, but it's more than that.
And if you're not part of that group, then it's not trivial at all.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of defined in that article as like being the power of normal is what white privilege kind of can be, because it's normal for these type of things to exist. We don't have to hunt down things in our skin color. It's normal to have Band-Aids this color. It's normal for the media to represent all of these white actors and actresses in whatever it is that we're watching. You don't have to hunt down a specific genre to see yourself represented. So that was very thought-provoking too in the article. I did find another quote. It's from 1989 by Harry Broad. And it was an article titled, Work Clothes and Leisure Suits, the Class Bias and the Bias of the Men's Movement. And I just really like this quote, and it also kind of put things into perspective as well. So I'm going to read that real quick. Harry Broad stated, we need to be clear that there's no such thing as giving up one's privilege to be outside the system. One is always in the system. The only question is whether one is part of the system in a way that challenges or strengthens the status quo. Privilege is not something I take and which therefore have the option of not taking. It is something that society gives me, and unless I change the institutions which give it to me, they will continue to give it and I will continue to have it, however noble and equalitarian my intentions are. I really liked it because sometimes, I mean, I personally have felt this way. White people can experience this kind of like white savior attitude, where it's like, well, I'm not part of the system. I don't think this way. I don't do these things. But white privilege is not something that we can just give or take away. It's just something we have. You don't have to think about it. It's just there. Right. And that's kind of a hard thing to swallow, to be honest.
And when we white people say that, I don't act that way, that's not who I am, that doesn't give you license to just sit on the sidelines and not participate. You know, that then becomes the impetus for you to work to break it down, to change the system rather than just sit idly by. And like the quote said, whether or not you take advantage of the advantage, it is still given to you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's exactly. Interesting. I like that.
And going along with that, something we can think about is that having white privilege does not mean you are racist. And I think a lot of white people think that that is what white privilege means. Like, I'm not saying that you're racist. I'm saying that we have this built-in system that makes some things easier for us. We have this privilege. The system is kind of built for us. And I think that is like the main thing I have to start with when I try to have these conversations with family members or friends who are maybe on the fence of like, I don't know what you're trying to say. I'm not calling you racist. I'm trying to define this term of what white privilege actually means.
And that can be difficult. That can be really difficult to start those conversations, because as soon as we start talking about things that have racial undertones or, you know, prejudicial vibes to them, people immediately get defensive. That's just human nature. That's something that's difficult for all of us to avoid. And immediately our walls come up and we start to push back. And like you said, that catchphrase of "I'm not racist." Well, I didn't say that you were. I'm saying that you've been given built-in advantages because of the color of your skin, the way that you look, the way your name is spelled. That has different endpoints than calling you a racist, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that is one of the most challenging parts of trying to increase diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts within a society, your workplace, your family and friend circles, is how do you start these conversations? How do you have these conversations without it turning into a heated argument where people just get mad and then no progress is made? So usually, especially when it comes to white privilege, I try to start with those things of what it is not, and starting with the preface that, you know, nobody is better than anyone else. Nobody's in the right. I'm not trying to point fingers at anyone. We're just here to try and unpack things, learn new things, unlearn things that are not necessarily correct, and trying to meet people where they are and get to a place of understanding. And it's easier said than done, for sure. It takes patience, and sometimes you have to walk away and come back, but it's the work that we need to do in order to make things better.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think if you set up with the mindset that you're going to change someone's opinion about these things in one conversation, then you're coming at it all wrong. You know, it should be your job to plant the seed, to show them that there is information out there, and to let them learn it at their pace and at their speed.
Absolutely. I love that phrase, planting the seed, triggering that curiosity that we naturally have, especially as scientists. It's like, I need to look more into that.
That's something that I was thinking about as we were leading up to this, is as scientists, we are all about trying to have the best information. And as we've seen with a lot of the COVID stuff in the last 18 months, going on 2 years now, science doesn't change its mind. Science gets new information, and then the messaging needs to change. So it's kind of strange that we as scientists can be so reluctant to change our minds about these social issues when it's our job to take in new information and to have the best information about what we do as science. But we seem so reluctant to do that when it comes to social issues.
That is a great way to explain that and think about it. You think it would be second nature to scientists, like, well, this isn't working, let's try something different. Or like you said, information is always changing, and we can stay up on it when it comes to like our research projects or what we do in our workplace. But for the social situations, it for some reason is so tricky, and people are very reluctant to have any kind of change occur, whether that be like having your work group attend some kind of unconscious bias training, or making some kind of mandatory training happen within your workplace. It can really like rub people the wrong way. Or if you try to start a diversity, equity, and inclusion committee within a group or a society, sometimes it could be like a little pushback with the folks who have been there a long time, wondering, oh, why do we need this? We don't need this. And that's that white privilege right there, saying like, well, yeah, you don't think you need it because you're not one of the marginalized groups or underrepresented groups in this society or workforce. And it can make them uncomfortable because then they think that they're in trouble or getting the finger pointed at them for why these changes need to happen. And I think that's probably the wrong way to go about thinking.
Absolutely. You know, there can't be any finger pointing when we're trying to be more inclusive. It kind of goes against the whole movement that we're trying to move here. This needs to be about all of us getting better.
And then some things I wanted us to talk about were just kind of like, well, where does white privilege fit in fisheries or kind of the fish and wildlife field in general? And the main example that I think of and have seen happen, and we have all actually seen happen in the news, is people of color being harassed when they're out in the field because they are suspected of being up to no good, or that they are not a valid scientist in any way. And usually law enforcement is called. And that's something that we don't have to think about when we go out in the field to conduct research. Again, the white privilege can be defined as like the power of the benefit of the doubt. It is assumed if you see a bunch of white people on a boat handling some fish, okay, they're probably doing some kind of research or they're commercial fishermen. But if it was a group of people of color, they could possibly get police called on them or something like that because of the color of their skin. And that's just something that we don't have to think about. You mentioned it earlier before, someone's hair type or hair texture. Natural hair for people of color is for some reason deemed unprofessional in some places, in some academic spaces, which doesn't make any sense at all because that is their natural hair texture. And you also mentioned names. Having a name that doesn't, in quotes, sound white, those people may be disregarded when it comes to jobs or internships or getting a paper published, those sorts of things. It's just something that I think we don't think about.
No, I agree. And there are phenomenally trained and educated researchers from all over this planet who are doing really good work on a lot of different systems and a lot of different species. That's something that I've started to become exposed to in the last 4 or 5 years as I do peer review for more and more papers. Is you get, you know, international journals, articles from Asia or Africa or South America, where you start to not only learn about those systems and how that can affect your research or change what you do with your focal species, but just continually broadening your horizons that, you know, life is not only more than the four walls of your office, but it's broader than the boundaries of your country too.
Absolutely. I think what we should do definitely is amplify those voices, especially in the fisheries field.
One thing I wanted to bring up, and I don't know if it's appropriate to this or not, is that we're aging through a generation of fisheries professionals that were completely white and male. And I think that, you know, the current generation, probably starting with me and moving through people like you, not starting with me, but starting with people my age and moving through people like you, have done a really good job of starting to integrate women into the field of fisheries. And it seems like a lot of quote unquote us think that that was good enough. We let one group into the boys club and that was good enough. And now we don't have to do anything more. And there seems to be this reluctance to do anything beyond that, whether it's, you know, non-binary genders, orientations, or people of color, or, you know, these other underrepresented groups in fisheries. And there seems to be this, well, we let the girls into the boys club. Do we have to let all these other people in too? And I don't know what to do about that. I guess that's one of the reasons that we're here today, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have. I did kind of notice that when I first joined the American Fisheries Society, when I first started working as a technician and kind of entering the world of fish and wildlife research. People have said to me at conferences before, look how many women are here. We're doing so good. Just like,
I mean, yes, but that's the first step in a journey of 1,000 miles. So congrats, you took a step, but there's more that needs to be done.
Right, exactly. The work should never stop, just like our research, you know, never really stops. Like you said earlier, it is constantly evolving. Information is changing. That's how we need to approach these social situations within our workplaces and societies. It's not just like one and done, check. I think that happens a lot with when people make like a diversity and inclusion group or a committee. It's like, okay, well, we did it. We made this group, and sometimes we meet and talk about things. So that's enough, right? No, I mean, that's a really great first step. The challenge is getting actionable commitments, things that your group can actually hopefully accomplish. There's no like timeline really. It's just trying to tackle these things one at a time. And it can be very intimidating and very difficult, but we have to do more than just check that box. That's like, we did a diversity and inclusion thing. We're good. Or have one training. We're good now. I think that's personally, like, as white people, we think like, oh, we've done so much. I did this thing and now we're done.
We did the token thing. Exactly. We're done.
Uh-huh. This is cool that we see a lot more women, but we shouldn't just settle there. Like you said, we need to keep moving. There are more than two genders. We have many people of color. We have Indigenous and Native peoples that need to be included in these spaces. And it can be scary, I think, for white people to be like, well, how do I tackle this? So our first instinct is to ask the people of color or gender nonconforming people we know, hey, explain what this means. And that can actually be really exhausting and frustrating for those groups. The responsibility shouldn't fall on those that are underrepresented and marginalized. It should really fall on us, the majority, who the system was built for, who have those privileges to make those changes. It takes that self-education that you have to keep going. Otherwise, change is not going to happen. And I think that's something that we struggle with the most, is it's not fixable right now. It's deeply rooted systemic problems that we are trying to tackle in all of our little groups and bubbles.
And that's why I think it's good for these DEI committees or these volunteers, people like us, to lead this, to lead these kinds of initiatives to make things better for all of us, to make for more inclusive scientific societies. Because it's we who are driven to do this, we tend to kick that can a little farther. We tend to keep the ball rolling and encourage, to continually encourage those members of our groups to be open to this, you know, getting back to that planting the seed metaphor. If you just keep throwing seeds, some of it's going to stick somewhere. It may take five handfuls to break through to certain groups. And there are some you're just never going to get. And that's just the way it is. But if we can move, if we can move the needle for those groups who are willing to be moved, who just don't have the knowledge and the information about touchy topics like white privilege. That's our purpose and our goal and the point of us having podcasts like this, to educate and inform those who are willing to move this forward. You know, maybe by listening to this, someone gets the bug in their ear to go track down this article and read about what white privilege is, and then can not only educate themselves, but pass that on. Maybe it inspires them to join their DEI group, or at least to work in their office or in their own life to be more inclusive.
Couldn't agree more. So some things we've already kind of touched on was like, well, what do we do now? At least I was feeling this way for a while, and probably a lot of other white people. Like, what do we do? Now that I recognize this problem and have learned about this issue, what do we do about it? And there's definitely various ways, and we've already kind of touched on a little bit, ranging from an individual level of responsibility to the leadership within the groups or societies that you're a part of, or your workforce, whatever that may be. Starting with, I think the most important is just listening, having an open heart and mind, and being okay with being uncomfortable when we have these kind of conversations, and listening to especially people of color if they want to talk about, well, this is how it affects me, this is my experience, and not butting in to share your kind of experience that might relate a little bit, or try to silence these people who are talking.
My wife, Sue, would emphasize listening to hear, not listening to reply.
I love that.
I'm listening to you.
I remember that one.
I'm listening to you, but I want to hear you. I want to understand. I want to digest and process. Whereas so many people listen to interrupt, to reply, to come back with their story or their feelings, or their, most of the time, rebuttal to whatever point it is you're trying to make. But actually listening to hear, to understand.
Oh, exactly. I love that. That's fantastic. I think, like you said earlier, it's our instinct to be defensive And that can be very difficult, I think, for us just as humans in general, is to just stop and hear and think about it rather than immediately jump to those defenses and come back with a rebuttal or an experience or something. It's very challenging. So that can be an individual challenge for all of us.
Even if what you're going to reply with is an affirmation, you know, or supportive of the person that you're talking to, just shut up and listen to them and actually hear what they're saying. Try and envision it from their point of view rather than sharing the story about what you have to share.
Exactly. Yeah, that also leads to just other things we can do. I kind of talked about earlier is amplifying the voices of people of color who are in our fields. So for the annual meeting in Baltimore this year, we do have a whole symposium that's dedicated to diversity, equity, inclusion, and the equal opportunity section as well has a whole section. And we have all these amazing speakers. And I'm really, really happy that the Fisheries Society put aside a whole symposium that we could do this and share these things. And I hope that it becomes a regular thing within the American Fisheries Society, that we amplify these voices, we have specific workshops towards these type of things. And it becomes kind of our new normal, so that we are constantly having these discussions. Better visibility, better representation, those are things that we need to provide for people of color. You just think about walking into a conference and you're not seeing people that look like you, that can be very disheartening.
And intimidating. A lot of these scientific conferences are intimidating enough for new members, whether they're new graduate students or undergrad technicians or whomever, because you're walking into rooms with people who you've either looked up to or people whose papers you've read, or just old people that have been doing this a long, long time. And that can be intimidating. I remember that when I started out in this field, and now I'm starting to become one of those old people that can see the wide-eyed kids walking in the conference doors for the first time. And I remember, I'm not so far removed that I don't remember what that feels like.
It is very scary and intimidating. Definitely. Yeah, so making those spaces feel more safe and inclusive, I think, should be a huge step. Something really fun, though, this is like a shameless plug for the Equal Opportunity section. We are having an LGBTQ and BIPOC is Black, Indigenous, and People of Color, kind of like a safe space social at the Baltimore meeting. If anyone's going to be there in person, it'll be the opening night, same as the first big social that they're having that night. I think that starts at 6. Ours will start at 7. It'll be in a separate room. We're going to have all these details to share later on, but we just want people to know that this is going to be an open space, and we confer that all are welcome here. Outdoors is for everyone. These kind of jobs are for everyone. And we just want people to know that that safe space exists. And I think creating those safe spaces is a really good step in having your society move towards being more inclusive. So we're very excited for that. And we're thinking we're also going to do a virtual portion for folks that can't attend physically. So having access to those things, I think, is really important. I think what we could do as well as a society is maybe do a lot of more outreach and education. I know a lot of us do that already, but maybe putting in a little extra to maybe reach historically Black colleges and universities, or really starting at the youngest age possible, I think, is how you plant the seed of getting folks into the fish and wildlife fields, is doing events for schools, for kids, finding groups that you can interact with and build trust with, so they know, okay, this is something that I could do. I could be a scientist. I could work outdoors if I wanted to. This is something that's for me. And when kids see that that's an option, I think they're more likely to grow up into adults that want to do those things.
One thought about that is a lot of states have urban fishing programs to try and target those populations that may not have the opportunity that other groups did to get experienced to hunting and fishing. And those are definitely good things. I've got friends in other states who run their urban fishing programs. But there seems to be a disconnect between, you know, bringing a trailer full of Zebco push fishing poles to the local trout pound or bluegill pond and showing people that fishing is fun and you can catch food and things like that. There seems to be a disconnect between that group or those efforts for the urban fishing program and you can do this for a job. You know, you can do this as a career. You can squeeze fish for a living. And I don't know how to make that switch if the urban fishing program is the route to do that, or if that needs to be the springboard into, okay, we're going to bring the urban fishing program trailer, but we're also going to send a biologist into those, you know, middle school classrooms on career day and share that, you know, you can do this.
Absolutely. Yes. I see that as well. The Missouri Department of Conservation has a few free fishing days throughout the year. And that's a similar effort of, you know, you don't have to have a fishing license on this day. You can come and fish, learn how to fish. And there's people who will show you how to get the worm on the hook, get the fish off the hook, what species of fish this is, why it's cool. I love those kind of programs. And this is not to discredit them. It's just like, I think we could do more. We could always do more, right? Mm-hmm. We don't want to just settle and say, we have this one program that's good enough. But I do love that we have, the American Fisheries Society has the Hutton program, where high schoolers can have a paid summer internship, which is a huge barrier for a lot of folks. Having a paid internship, not working for free, these kids are earning a paycheck while getting this experience, getting their foot in the door, so to speak, of a fish and wildlife career. And that is just huge. I would love to see the Hutton program blow up even more and reach more students, because I think due to like funding and the availability of mentors, if we could grow programs like that, put a lot more effort into those things, we could definitely change what we see when we go to a conference, all of these different people who maybe didn't think that they could be a part of the fisheries world or the fish and wildlife world.
It takes time, money, and effort. You have to want to make these changes. You know, it's something that agencies should consider. If you're looking for summer interns from one program or multiple programs, think about something like Hutton. You know, think about intentionally hosting a student from a group like that focuses on underrepresented people in fisheries. I had a great experience 15 years ago working in Michigan with a girl from the Native American band who was a Hutton student one summer with us when I was working on my master's at Grand Valley. And it's just something that's kind of fallen off my radar since then. We've had interns from a couple other programs here at the History Survey, but something that I actually just scribbled a sticky note, stuck to my computer monitor, that I want to explore for the coming years here.
And that can be difficult, is we're already balancing all of these things, and trying to add another thing, I think, can be very intimidating, frustrating. I don't have the time to do that. I mean, we're doing all of this diversity, equity, inclusion work because we want to. It's not like it is our job. We have all of these separate jobs and other things going on, but we have to make that commitment. We have to make time for these things. And I think when we get more than one person involved so that it can kind of lift the burden a little bit, then I feel like we can accomplish more.
Sure.
So I really love being part of the equal opportunity section of AFS, because it's just like-minded people who want to get things done, and it's really cool.
It does become a little bit easier when it's a community effort rather than just an individual effort too.
How do we tackle this thing that is white privilege? And in that Learning for Justice article, they have a similar conclusion saying, well, what can I do once I recognize this, once I have learned about this? And the first thing they have listed is, don't take it personally or use discomfort as an excuse to disengage. And I think we also kind of talked about that.
Like, you're not allowed to sit on the sidelines.
I don't really
want to
get into that.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Learn when to listen, when to amplify, and when to speak up. And we talked about those things as well. Yeah, not just when to listen, but how to listen, like you said. And next step, again, educate yourself. Self-education, I think that's the most important part of diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts, is self-education, not relying on those that are underrepresented or marginalized to educate you. You need to take the responsibility, and especially as scientists, we should be used to this. We're used to having to do our own research to figure out what is going on in whatever it is that we're researching or studying. So this should also apply to what we do in our social bubbles and what we experience in our workspaces and our society spaces, taking the effort to educate yourself.
Unlearn the bad stuff first. You know, you need to unlearn what is wrong as a scientist and as a member of society, and then learn what is right, what is current, And if that turns out to be, and if that turns out to be wrong in the future, then unlearn that and relearn it again. That adaptive learning process that should be second nature to us as scientists, like we said earlier, that is so hard for us to do as members of society.
For some reason, I think we as humans, we feel bad if we get new information and something changes and we've been doing something that's technically been wrong this whole time, afraid to acknowledge that. And that shouldn't be a problem. New information, now we do it this way. And that should be fine. There's nothing wrong with that. We're constantly needing to unlearn and learn in order to grow. And I think that's something we should be okay with. It's just like doing an experiment. This didn't work. Let's try this instead. And if that doesn't work either, keep moving forward. You don't have to sit in this weird guilt or uncomfortableness of, well, now I don't know what to do. You just have to keep trying. There's nothing wrong with trying. We're just trying to do our best because nobody's perfect. We're not going to get it right all the time. The point, I think, is that you're working towards these things, just having these conversations and joining groups and committees that are working towards these things.
Absolutely. That last part on the Learning for Justice article, risk your unearned benefits to benefit others. Like we talked about at the outset, you know, white privilege is something, it was in that longer quote that you shared that you didn't earn it, but that doesn't mean that you don't have it. And just setting it down isn't fair to you, but also to the groups that we're trying to help move forward, help amplify, you know, use that white privilege, use that voice, that face to make some noise about this in the right place and in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, use that privilege, that power even to do some good, you know, to make the right noise in the right place, to speak up for those who can't speak up for themselves. I kind of joke with a couple of my technicians who I was talking about this with the other day. It's a lot what Peter Parker /Spider-Man's Uncle Ben told him way back in the comic book series was use your powers for good, not for evil. You know, this is a privilege that has been given to white people. Use those powers for good. Don't just set that. You can't set it down. It's something that you have. So take what you've been given, take this privilege, this gift that you've been given, and do something good with it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Jason.
You're welcome.
Are just a delight to talk to all the time.
Thank you for the invitation. This was something I was initially reluctant to do because it's talking about white privilege, which is an uncomfortable topic. But I read, I learned, I told you, sure, I'll do it. And I've enjoyed it. I just hope that people get something out of it.
Yes, absolutely. I think it could be a great learning experience for anyone who takes the time to listen and hopefully further educates themselves on the topic and takes a second to think about things that happen in their daily life or things that they experience or don't experience because of the color of their skin.
Plant the seed, let it grow.
Yes, let it grow. Thank you so much, Jason. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
You're welcome, Cass. I had a good time. Thank you.
Special thanks to the Fisheries Podcast for hosting us on their established feed at fisheriespodcast.podbean.com and for also tackling important diversity and inclusion topics in their normal feed. Also, find us and other diversity and inclusion resources on diversity.fisheries.org. The custom lo-fi music beat was crafted by Darius Armstrong. Look for his music name, Karl Marx, on www.bandcamp.com/releases. We are very grateful to all those AFS leaders and members who have provided support and feedback as we have brought this podcast to life.